From the bizarre world of the paranormal to the sinister secrets of the U.S. government, the Black Vault has become known worldwide as the premier spot for anything and everything conspiracy. Now, join me, John Greenwald Jr., as we dive into the research together in hopes to decipher these mysteries. This is the Black Vault Radio. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Black Vault Radio. I am your host, John Greenwald Jr. Today's show, I'm very much looking forward to. We have Mr. Jason Martell, a longtime friend and colleague of myself. We first met about 9 years ago, I think it was, when we both lectured for the Mutual UFO Network. And that particular chapter is in the Ventura, Santa Barbara area. And we met then, and he has pretty much devoted his life ever since, because this was in his beginning days of research, to ancient astronauts and the potential theory that an alien or extraterrestrial race, however you want to call it, may have intervened in human evolution. And this is fascinating to me. I am by far not a scientist. I really don't know what I'm talking about when it comes to that area, which actually may be evident in this show, so don't hold it against me. But I'm looking forward to asking just those everyday questions about human evolution. But further, how is it evident that this intervention may have taken place in human evolution? I mean, I find that fascinating. And he brings up Jason Martell brings up a very good point, that when you look at our human history, when you look at the technology that came almost overnight, when you look at the structures that all of a sudden a very primitive race started building, these humongous pyramids and huge structures, when you look at that, you can't help but think, maybe there was some kind of intervention. Now, what was it? And Jason has unearthed some pretty amazing information to share with you all, so stay tuned. Jason is coming up right here on the Black Vault Radio. But a few announcements before I get rolling. I'm very excited to say that the Black Vault has finally, and I say finally because I have been trying to get this online for quite some time, launched a video streaming or broadband video or streaming, I don't know what you want to call it. There's just a bunch of videos online to download. And it's a section that has, I would say, about 50 hours already of streaming video that you can download and view right inside your browser for free, right from the Black Vault. The subjects include many declassified videos from the U.S. government and United States military. There's some fascinating footage in there that is very rarely seen, and I say rarely seen because I really kind of had to scrounge around for this stuff, some of which was obtained via the Freedom of Information Act and digitized by myself. If you're interested in the Freedom of Information Act, which is how I got all of this stuff, go into the miscellaneous videos and you'll see like this, I don't know if it's not a documentary, it's more of a training video for the Freedom of Information Act case officers produced by our own U.S. government. But it's hysterical, and I say that because the way they produced it was they've got this 1920s look-alike actor that, I hate to say cheesy, because maybe he's tuning in, maybe he's a big fan of the Black Vault Radio, so I apologize. But it's just funny to watch. You'll see a picture of him right even before you download it, so go check it out. It's very well worth the wait. I've even got in there, also in the same category, a 2.5-minute public service announcement done in the 1950s, produced by our United States military, on how to not blow yourself up with a model rocket. Now, the description's a little bit more funny than what it really is. It is exactly that. It's a 2.5-minute public service announcement for the children who were really getting into model rocketry as they were seeing through news and newspapers that so was our United States government. So when model rockets started taking out in the 60s, I think it was the 50s or 60s they produced this thing, they wanted to make sure, hey, don't blow yourself up. So stay tuned to the Black Vault Radio. Make sure you check out those videos. You can also surf while you're listening here to the Black Vault, www.theblackvault.com or www.xfax.com. That's Jason's site. Jason Martell coming up right after this break. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Black Vault Radio. And welcome back, everybody. This is the Black Vault Radio. I don't want to waste any time getting our guest on this week, Mr. Jason Martell, owner and operator of xfacts.com. He's got a ton of information to download to us today right here on the Black Vault Radio. So, Jason, first off, let me welcome you to the show.
Thank you very much for having me on, John. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, thank you for taking the time out of your day to come on and tell us a little bit about your research. You know, I told people before the break, but I wanted to remind you about our first meeting, how we both did a lecture together for MUFON Ventura Santa Barbara chapter many, many years ago. That's where we first met. And so it's great to have you on sharing your research and glad to know that you're still at it. Let me go ahead and let you take the floor. Tell me a little bit about what you research and why it's so important.
Sure. Well, thanks. I've been studying for the last 10 years or so, as you said. We go long back, even though we're still both young in the field. My focus has really been on, it started off looking at the structures on Mars and NASA's handling of the information, of the data they give us for the images and satellite telemetry that comes from Mars, possible region of the face and pyramids known as Cydonia. And that kind of broadened my search into thinking about, well, if there's pyramids in a face on Mars, we have megalithic structures all over the Earth here that really don't have answers laid in stone for how they were built. And so that's really kind of where my research has gone in the last few years and to this day, is expanding on the where we come from as far as human origins, and focusing on the first civilization that we've ever found record of, which is modern-day Iraq, then called Sumer. And from that, I've kind of branched out, which we'll discuss in today's show, some of the new artifacts and pieces of ancient technology, which shed light on the theory that ancient man was aware or was at least witnessing types of technology, the power of flight possibly, and was possibly interacting with what we would call extraterrestrials, and this has been recorded in texts all around the world as interaction with their gods.
And this is a fascinating part of your research, because, and correct me if I'm wrong, what I deduce from this is that here, going back to the caveman days, we have some fairly simple-minded people creating some kind of society, if that's what you want to call it at that time. And then all of a sudden, you've got the pyramids, you've got Stonehenge, you've got all these big structures. There's kind of a missing gap. Is that correct? What do you propose is that gap?
Well, you know, here's another way I would phrase it. Because, you know, a lot of people are still not, maybe not listeners to your show, but many people aren't still fully on board with the idea that we have been visited by extraterrestrials, or that there's evidence to show, you know, that we've been visited by extraterrestrials. It's kind of an elusive thing to pinpoint. But what I show sometimes is a bridge to some of the things that are discussed in the ancient times, is even in more recent times, we have things, you know, that kind of relate towards, you know, this theory we call the ancient astronaut theory, meaning that sometime in the past, astronauts from other planets, other, you know, non-human or possibly human, you know, have visited us. And so we can look to scenarios even in more recent times to confirm the stories that we see coming out of the Bible and these other sacred texts. As an example, you know, in the 1940s, just after World War I, when we sent American pilots over to remote regions in Africa, and they set up base camps, this is the first time some of these aboriginals had been exposed to, one, the white man and their technology, meaning they step out of a prop plane and light up their cigarette with a lighter, hold up a little voice recorder and record, you know, the aboriginal speech and then play it back to them, and they're fascinated. They don't understand this technology or how they're able to make this happen. So, you know, these people, the soldiers eventually pack up and leave, and the aborigines start to build straw models of the airplanes and scraping away runways and worshiping these in the sense that they would hope that they would come back. Wow. And now this is referred to in modern times as a cargo cult, where other things that they had happen was that they would, you know, be drops of food supplies and stuff, and sometimes they would land in some tribe and they would crack this open and it's full of food and all these advanced things, and they thought it was from the gods. So there's a whole scenario that can be played out in even much further past times where we see the same type of evidence being displayed to us, but there's a hurdle of saying, oh, well, they couldn't have actually been experiencing what they're writing down or worshiping because it's mythology. It's just a creation story.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what if this is something that actually has happened?
That's fascinating. So let me back you up then. What kind of technology do you think appeared way back then that you would say, hey, look, you can't say that these guys picked it up by themselves?
Sure. Well, let's start with some of the megalithic monuments.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all over the earth, from the Nazca lines in Peru to what, you know, I've been kind of interested in lately is the South American structures, Giza, of course. So we have all this architecture around the world that shows monuments that have been laid out, and they're not just on one continent, they're all around the world that have astronomical alignments built into the architecture in such a way where it's mathematically perplexing to modern science.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those would be, of course, the pyramids and the Sphinx in Egypt as an example. Not many people realize that, you know, these are being claimed to have been built in 2500 BC by the Egyptian culture, which is great, and I, you know, not to take anything away from the Egyptian culture. However, the pyramids basically are mapped to a date astronomically, which is 10,500 BC. And this can be scientifically proven because when we use star charts and constellation maps like Redshift and other various software that you can run on your PC, you can track where the stars are going to appear in the sky, both forward in time and backward. And it turns out in 10,500 BC, the pyramids, the three pyramids of Giza, are a terrestrial map of the Orion constellation. And at that same time, the Sphinx, which is the shape of a lion, is staring east into the direct gaze of the Leo constellation, which is a lion.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a terrestrial alignment taking place with constellations at 10,500 BC so accurately that it kind of boggles modern science to accept that these possibly, the pyramids and the Sphinx, are much, much older than what we currently postulate. And so that's kind of a starting point, John, of another interest that I've started to realize. And we hear theories of like an Atlantean culture or some advanced race that must have been here, but where are they? Where's the evidence? Well, it seems the evidence is all around us because these megalithic monuments, Giza, and in South America, Machu Picchu, Tiwanaku, Teotihuacan, there's all these huge megalithic monuments that when you go back to these cultures, whether it be the Egyptians or the Mayans, and say, who built these? There are some discrepancies as to the date, because it turns out many of these monuments range from the 10 to 13,000 range and could be remnants from a past civilization that's been here long, long ago.
And what I want to encourage all the listeners to do right now is, as you're listening via theblackvault.com, you can surf the internet while you're listening and go to www.xfacts.com. That's Jason's site. Jason, you have a couple of them, one of which is called the Mars-Earth Connection. And
yeah.
In a Discovery Channel segment that you did, you've been all over television, but namely a Discovery Channel segment that you can download via your site. You talk about this Mars-Earth Connection, and it really connects the pyramids of Giza, the Sphinx, to Mars. How so?
Well, it's really still kind of a mystery to me at this point, other than I see similarities played out that, you know, if there are a face and pyramids on Mars and we have a Sphinx and pyramids in Egypt, there must be some type of a connection. Now, beyond that, the only thing I would say is that when we look at some of the ancient records and information that come out of sources that are reliable, for instance, the Sumerian culture has, you know, the first written language, and their artifacts, stone written language artifacts, are stored in museums around the world. And some of these artifacts very specifically speak of Mars, and they have stories that explain how, you know, ancient man not only knew about the planets in our solar system, but how Mars was used as a way station for, you know, transportating mining operations that were happening here on Earth and happening on Mars. And so, you know, these are things coming out of ancient cultures where, again, our modern science isn't very, you know, very easily able to accept or understand this. So, you know, making a connection at this point to civilizations on Mars and in Earth is very hard to do with the resources we have available,
mm-hmm.
other than to look into the past and see if we can then scientifically confirm some of the things that they've left us, which that's what we've been trying to do.
That's very interesting, because one of the images they have on Mars, even though, again, it is a scientific mystery, is that they go from the pyramids that are nearby the face, which then could essentially be connected to the Sphinx somehow.
Yes.
And, you know, that's one heck of a coincidence.
Well, here's another interesting thing that I've kind of pondered about the Cydonia region. Now, theoretically, you know, there hasn't been rain on the Giza Plateau in 10,000 years, and I say that because it's a desert. But if we look at the erosion on the walls of the Sphinx, and this has been brought up by Robert Bruval and Graham Hancock, that you know, there's extensive weathering that's done by water and not by sand or any other natural occurrence. So at some point, the Giza Plateau had to have been inundated by water, and you know, the last time that could have taken place would be around 10,000 years ago at least. An interesting coincidence that I see in the Cydonia region of Mars, and not many people have pointed this out, even Dr. Mark Carlotto, who is an imaging specialist, for some reason never maybe just overlooked this, but if anyone looks at the Cydonia region where the large city is and the pyramid, and then if you look out to where the face is, there's actually something that looks as if the Cydonia region was built as lakefront property, mm-hmm. where the face would be out surrounded by water, and the D&M pyramid and the little Cydonia complex of the city, these would all be right on a shoreline that could look out and see the face. And if anyone looks at these raw images from NASA, you can actually see how the pyramid and these city-like structures are in a more bright, knobbyous terrain where it then mellows out to a darker, less knobby terrain where the face is, where you can clearly distinctly make out a shoreline, an ancient shoreline. And so it's very interesting that we see these same principles here on Earth, where just like I'm saying the pyramids and the Sphinx were probably built well beyond 10,000 years, and it looks like there's significant water damage on them, it's very possible, just as we like to live on, you know, lakefront property here on Earth,
right,
that seems to be being played out on Mars's history as well.
And also interesting to point out, you're not doing, I mean, maybe in the back end you're doing this, but when you first look at the data, you're not doing any tricks in the computer or anything like that. You're downloading straight from U.S. government computers, and you can download and see these images and all the data.
That's correct.
And are they still online? I haven't looked for them.
Of course. It's very prolific now that you could just basically type in certain keywords like Malin's MSSS Face on Mars, which is Malin Space Science Systems Face on Mars images. And there's just a plethora of images that are raw data. And they still kind of squeeze out a few every now and then, and they pop up on the Internet where we still have two or three orbiters, the Odyssey, Themisis, and Mars Global Surveyor, that are currently orbiting Mars. And I've been following Mars Global Surveyor since it launched in 1998, mm-hmm. almost a decade. And so every now and then they'll still kind of slap up a few images of the Cydonia region where they don't really publicly announce, or there's not a lot of banter on the Internet about, hey, go take pictures of the face, because they've done a really good job of downplaying any publicity by showing more and more reduced quality of what could actually be made out as a face. And it's very odd, John, because you look at the images from 1976, and the resolution is like, you know, 1,000 times less quality of what we would be able to see today, yet the face and pyramids look clearer. They look more like a face and pyramids versus today there's some type of odd, just like they've been bombarded or, you know, blown up or something.
And just last week they're releasing 3D images of the sun. So it's like, why can't they get clear images
right.
of this? You know, it's kind of bizarre. Jason, we're coming up to our second commercial break, I should say. And
okay.
We are talking to Jason Martell. Check out www.xfacts.com. Check it out while you're listening to the cool music here at theblackvault.com. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Stay tuned.
Fuck.
And welcome back to the Black Vault Radio. We're talking to Jason Martell about possible ancient astronauts not only influencing our own culture, but how maybe there was a civilization on Mars. Now, Jason, thank you so much for joining us and giving us this great information. We've been talking about the Mars-Earth connection, and although it is a scientific question mark, there's a lot of data that has yet to be explained, a lot of which we can download right now if you go online and you said search for MSSS Face on Mars. Is that correct?
That's correct. If you just typed in Face on Mars, probably.
And you can get all this raw data straight from the government, or all these images from the government. Now, you mentioned Dr. Mark Carlotto and a couple other scientists that may have overlooked some of this data. Let me ask you this question. If a skeptic came to you and said, oh, come on, well, NASA didn't really see this, and NASA scientists didn't accept it as truth, so it can't be true, what are you going to say to them?
Well, I would answer that on two fronts. One, NASA, National Aeronautics Space Association, does have a tendency to also stand for never a straight answer.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean that to publicize saying that they're, you know, wrong or not knowledgeable in what they're doing, but NASA has defense contracts and National Security Association budget funds that basically, when we launch one of these satellites like the Mars Global Surveyor into space, it also has other projects and telemetry that are attached to it that's classified. So if that thing needs to become a priority, the instrumentation that's classified needs to become, you know, more of a priority, we somehow lose the satellite or some odd thing happens to it and it stops transmitting. And this hasn't just happened one or two times. It's happened long enough that if anyone actually looks into this with a fine-tooth comb, they can actually see this track record. And so the faith in what we actually see provided by NASA isn't always what I would say the full picture. And so in doing that, you know, if a skeptic were to ask me, well, how do you prove that there's something here that, you know, we should be paying attention to that we're not being shown, I would say, one, you know, if you actually do the research, you will see the answer. But mm-hmm. two, on a very basic level, it's simply this. When NASA was formed in the early 1959, 60s, they consulted a big think tank called the Brookings Institute that advised NASA for sociological and political and economic reasons that, look, if you ever find evidence of aliens or some extraterrestrial bacteria and you bring it back here to Earth and it somehow, you know, affects us, all of this type of information or data needs to be quarantined from the public for at least 6 months. And that policy is extended to the point where things that we would think we see on Mars or stuff that might be going on in space, we really have no clue to the depth of that because of the fact that it's not public knowledge. So there's just a lot of esoteric points when you start to look into finding out the answers for what's happening actually in space, because there's a huge military blanket of information that covers the truth of that.
Now, let me ask you from a political standpoint, you know, NASA's funding is not what it was, and it's probably going down. I haven't seen the numbers in a couple of years, but it's probably going down every year, I'm sure.
Right.
And do you think that maybe they're just trying to stay away from that alien-slash-extraterrestrial accusation or some kind of statement that if they say that A or E word, that they're going to get their funding cut even more and essentially be out of a job?
You know, that's a good point. I mean, that's kind of been the argument for a long time, ufologically, is that NASA's basically under a power play for their funds so that they can't really be a public company, and they're just a front to be like, hey, we're NASA, and we're here for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to a certain degree that's been the case for a long time. But there is this weird push happening now with the private space industry and, you know, more of an interest in an openness for harnessing our own technologies and ways to do things where, you know, if there is this secret space program happening where NASA's basically been the front, I mean, when they landed on the moon, I mean, some of the direct quotes from astronauts are like, why are you sending us up here on tricycles when the military is here in Ferraris?
Yeah.
And again, anyone who really looks into this information, they can see that, you know, there's a very esoteric level of information that's kept from the public as far as our true advances in space and weaponry and all that things that, you know, it's not really my focus, but of course is kept close to the heart of interest because, mm-hmm. you know, if we're actually going to be able to see openly what's happening on other planets or what's happening in space, you know, we would need to be able to penetrate through this veil of secrecy surrounding, you know, we have things like the internet and GPS and these satellites. We should be able to log onto the internet at any time and like have webcams on the satellites to be just poking around and looking out in space for fun.
It'd be interesting.
And educating people.
And like you said, in the world of the internet, the nice thing, even though NASA doesn't come out and say, hey, look, this is a possible ancient shoreline and these guys are building beachfront property, they're getting that data out there for excellent researchers like yourself to tell people like me what it all means. Jason, we're at the bottom of the hour already. Let me go ahead and put you on hold for just 1 second. You're
all
listening
right
to the Black Vault Radio. I'm your host, John Greenwald Jr. from theblackvault.com. Make sure you check out xfacts.com while you're listening. We'll be right back.
You're listening to BVRN, the Black Vault Radio Network.
Back to the Black Vault Radio. I am your host, John Greenwald Jr., and I am talking to Jason Martell, owner and operator of xfacts.com. Check it out while you're listening. There's a lot of interesting information, not only that he is telling us on this show, but we don't have that much time to talk about all of his research, so make sure you check out his website. And Jason, as you and I were talking off the air during the break, it is so much fun to talk about this type of stuff.
Yes.
And get in those what-ifs and talk about, hey, what if NASA this or what if NASA that? But let me go ahead and bring you back to Earth for a second. And you mentioned some other types of technologies. We touched briefly about the monolithic structures like the pyramids, and we touched very briefly on Stonehenge.
Yes.
But one thing I want to make sure that I get you on goes way, way, way back, and you'll help me on exactly how far back, but with the Baghdad battery. Let me pass it to you. What is
that? Sure. Wow, that's a great one. In the collection of artifacts that I've been looking for that point to evidence of ancient technology that would really raise the eyebrow for, how could they have done this? There is a collection of artifacts that have come out of Iraq known as the Baghdad batteries. Now, they found about a dozen of them so far, and it's basically just a little clay pot that has a copper filling and an iron rod down the center. And they found traces of the acidic liquid like vinegar or sometimes like a wine, a grape juice. And they theorized that basically this is used as some type of a battery, and it's been called the Baghdad battery. There's been many theories as to what this could have been used for. On the academic front, it's archaeologically accepted that it was some type of battery, but they just don't know what it was used for. And there's a couple possible ideas, and one is the most mainstream thought is that it was used for electroplating, meaning if you take this little battery and fill it with like a grape juice or a vinegar, it actually will generate positive voltage. And so they theorized it was possible that they were using this to somehow heat up metals that could be then used to be sprayed over jewelry and things like that, electroplating. The other theory, which is a little bit more interesting, ties into the idea that it was used to power something like ancient electricity. Now, most people don't think that they have the power of a light bulb in the times of 2500 BC or the Egyptian culture, but we actually find evidence for a similarity where this battery, the Baghdad batteries, are ranging in the area of 2000 BC to have been utilized. So within that time frame, we find in some of the crypts in Egypt, in an area called Dendera, there are these wall reliefs, which, it's very clear they're holding up what look to be large light bulbs, and they're actually plugged into some type of a device, like a power unit. And what's baffled, people to this day is in some of these deep recesses of tombs and crypts in Egypt, there is no evidence of a flame being burnt, no soot or carbon. So the only other theory they could say is, well, they were using copper mirrors to reflect the light way down in there. Not going to happen. So an alternative theory is they were actually harnessing electricity.
That's absolutely fascinating. I mean, 1,000 questions just poured into my head to ask you. My first and foremost is, put that onto a timeline for me. How much earlier is this than the modern, granted, not an Energizer battery, but how we as civilization today, as we know it, started harnessing power like that? I mean, are we talking 50 years, 500 years? What are we talking?
Well, just as a basic range, we're talking about 2000 BC, and we're in 2007, so that's 2007 going back from AD to BC, and then another 2,000 years from that point back. So we're talking roughly 4,000 years ago.
Wow, that's
so. Yeah, there's a big gap in the Thomas Edison and some of the things today or that Italian gentleman, I forgot his name actually, that invented the light bulb, to looking back in time and seeing that, this could have been taking place. And as you pointed out, I did an on-camera special with the Discovery Channel, where I had a clay pottery expert recreate several models of the Baghdad battery to scale with a copper lining and an iron rod down the center. And I tested these on camera using grape juice, and I generated with just one of these 4 volts steadily and pretty quickly, too.
Yeah, it was very quick, actually.
Yeah, so if you figure one battery stacked up, maybe 2 or 3 of these, you quickly reach the 9 or 12 volt range to what we have today to power modern devices like a flashlight.
That's absolutely amazing that you were able to do this. And it's all on camera. Is it xfacts.com? That's the site that they can download that video. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, fantastic. xfacts.com. Download the video because it is an absolutely amazing presentation of this replica Baghdad battery. And Jason here talks about how it's created, which is pretty darn simple if you ask me. And then you show right on camera, boom, 4 volts right off the bat.
Interesting question there, John, is though, who could have taught them that? Like, did they just figure this out on their own? How is this knowledge learned? And so that starts to raise the question of some of these other artifacts and things that we've seen throughout history where we have many recorded versions of the power of flight, whether it be artifacts or imagery that man has been witnessing in the skies and has recorded as witnessing the power of flight. So these things are then, we wonder, well, how could they have learned, or why would they be, how would they have this knowledge? Where could it have come from? And it ties over into another area of some of these artifacts and an interest where throughout history on every continent, every culture, there are artifacts where they're explaining they were witnessing the power of flight, whether it be by their gods or just, occurrences of artifacts that they've left us, which are just too much of a similarity for modern-day technology. And I'll run through some very specific examples. There was a wooden artifact. It's actually on display in the Egyptian Museum in Cairo. It was found in 1898 in Saqqara, Egypt, and it's basically been dated to be around 200 BC for its creation. And it's interesting because it was rediscovered by a Dr. Messiah who studies ancient models and, requested that the Egyptian government put it on display, and they called it a wooden bird model. But if you look at it, it looks exactly like a biplane, a modern-day biplane. And we have some of these other artifacts that come out of Egypt, which you've probably heard about in Abydos. There's a wall relief that shows some of these things that look like a helicopter, some spacecraft. you know, it's very clearly an anomalous description of what we would currently see today in our arsenal of flying vehicles.
Now, let me stop you there. What kind of, because I've seen that picture, it's, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's spelled A-B-Y-D-O-S, in case anybody wants to search for it on Google. I'm sure they'll come up with an image of it. And it I mean, it's not only like a helicopter. There's one that looks like a Cessna. There's one that looks like a blimp. There's one that looks, I mean, and it's all right there that you can see all on the same plate. Mm-hmm. What kind of research has been done on this, or is it just a given that those are hieroglyphics on the wall and that's it?
Well, there's the discrepancy of a one simple stopping point, the extraterrestrial line, meaning no modern academia or archaeologist still will accept today that we've been visited by extraterrestrials, period. So if you can't step beyond that, there's no way to be open-minded enough to even think about the idea that they could have seen or have been somehow harnessing this type of technology. Now, the theory, which I'll show you a few more of these artifacts or explain them, the theory I put forth isn't that they were actually flying around in these craft, but that they were witnessing these things in the sky, meaning just like the straw models that were made by the Aborigines, we see this same evidence happening thousands of years earlier of artifacts just so accurate in detail being rendered, but maybe not the knowledge of how it works, just a conveyance of what they were seeing repeatedly. So that's just a very interesting point that I point out, that I don't think that it's possibly the ancient man was actually flying around in these craft, but they were definitely describing what they were seeing to us in a sense that's very real of a comparison of what we have today.
And it's... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, just real quickly, I was going to say, even in South America, there are some pre-Columbian airplane models that were, again, probably in the 500 to 800 BC area, and, you know, they look like biplanes, and archaeologists today label these as insect models, little tiny flying insects, but when you look at it from the perspective of what I'm saying and a comparison of cultures from around the world that show evidence of the power of flight, they look like little airplanes.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating, and it ties in a little bit to then fast-forwarding in history a little bit, but still going back a couple thousand years or 1,500 years on some of the artwork, the biblical artwork.
That's correct, Renaissance artwork.
Exactly, that really has these UFOs flying in the air, and I say UFOs because they're like saucer-shaped, and you go beyond the biplanes and see these saucer-shaped. I remember one off the top of my head where this craft, it's like a beam of light coming through a craft into a building. I mean, it's like fascinating material to look at with really no explanation whatsoever.
There's actually a couple of really famous ones that I like. There's one in Yugoslavia that's a fresco in a monastery, and actually I've posted this on YouTube, so if you just type in... I think it's just X-Fax UFO on YouTube. I have that the video posted. But it's an ancient monastery that in the 15th century shows Jesus being crucified, and in the background there are humans flying these craft. And another famous painting, which you've probably seen, is this famous painting of Madonna and the Saint Giovanni. It's still held in Florence.
Yes.
And it's a very interesting, because right over the left shoulder of the Madonna, there's a gentleman standing on the shoreline with his dog, squinting and holding his hand over his eye and looking up at this glowing craft in the sky.
Isn't he he's pointing also at it, isn't he?
That's right. He's pointing, and he's just kind of looking up at it, but his dog is also looking up at it as well. And it's just a very interesting conveyance of, looks just like our modern-day flying saucer, with the ray-emitting lights of the same thing we would see today, meaning if some very high-powered energy craft is in our atmosphere, a gaseous atmosphere, the reaction is going to be photons, light. That's why anytime you see a plane in the sky or any type of UFO report, it's usually, we saw lights in the sky. Well, of course you've seen a light. It's, an energy source reacting with a gaseous atmosphere. So it's very interesting to see in some of these ancient artwork the same exact clarity of how a craft affecting our atmosphere would be, emitting rays of light.
Yeah, it is an unbelievable topic to discuss, and we can go on for hours about it. But let me switch gears a little bit, because I have to ask you, where then are these extraterrestrials coming from? I mean, the evidence is there in artwork. The evidence is there physically with scientific, really, anomalies
sure.
that can't be explained. So let's get away from that and start theorizing, okay, where? From where?
Well, and that's kind of been one of my key interests, John, is where, show me the money. Where are they? And it's, for me, it's really been about utilizing the sciences we have today to try and wrap my brain around that question. And for me, it's led and put onto the shoulders of the first civilization we have on Earth. It's called Sumer. It's ancient Iraq, modern-day Iraq, southern Iraq. It's been called Mesopotamia, Babylon, but the first civilization that pops up is called Sumer, right out of the Stone Age. And it's unbelievable. It's like our civilization has taken like a roller coaster of tall dips and points of, you know, on peaks of we get technology and then we lose it. The Sumerians, right out of the Stone Age, are attributed of with one over 100 of the firsts for having a civilized culture, from everything to mathematics, written language, systems of laws, courts and judges, astronomy, agriculture, medicine, everything. It's just many, many things. Kingship, the idea of taking a man and a woman having marriage, all of this originated in Sumer. And if you look up today in any institution for the origins of mathematics or written language, you'll find that they originate in Sumer. Now, another interesting tale that comes along with all of this information that we can scientifically prove is accurate from what they were saying comes their creation stories, meaning the Sumerians have recorded recorded stories in stone which parallel all of the biblical tales today written in the New Testament, King James Version, and in the Hebrew Old Testament. And what we're basically finding is the original derivatives of these biblical tales found in a Sumerian stone version. So it gets kind of interesting, John, because some of these stories directly talk about a time when the Anunnaki were here on Earth. Just like it has in the Bible, there were giants upon the Earth, or the Nephilim in the Hebrew Bible. There are these stories that come out of Sumer in these stone versions, which are the original derivatives. And let me give you an example. In the early 1900s, when British archaeologists started doing excavations in Iraq, one of the tablets that was found by an assistant to the British Museum, a George Smith, found something that as he was reading this script, it was an Akkadian script, which is basically a derivative of the cuneiform, a very similar like shoot-off of this original written language that we find here on Earth. He starts to read the tablet, and it's basically talking about how a Sumerian man is chosen by a Sumerian god, an Anunnaki, to build a very large craft and to put his family and all the animals that he could find into this craft because there was going to be a great flood. And mind you, this is a stone version thousands and thousands of years before any written tale of a flood tablet or, you know, of a flood story.
Wow.
So he freaked out and raised his hands in amazement saying, "Oh my goodness, I can't believe it," because now it's, you know, on display in the British Museum as accepted, entitled The Flood Tablet, the original version of the flood story.
Wow. That's fascinating. So where do you think then these Anunnaki came from?
Well, that's where modern archaeology today is has that stopping point is the extraterrestrial line.
Mm-hmm.
There have been several other alternative views, you know, put forth by people like Eric von Daniken, Zachariah Sitchin, and I too have now, you know, feel like I'm going to pursue this for the rest of my life and pushing the idea that, you know, it's very clear when we analyze these ancient stories of man's interaction with their living gods, when viewed through a scientific, you know, microscope, there's actually a lot of credibility that should be given here. Unfortunately, we've just never seen these extraterrestrials ourselves. So to answer your question, you know, the best answer that I've been able to see for looking for our origins or, you know, how we got here is these stories from the, you know, the creation stories of the Sumerian text. Now, I was raised as a Christian, and I've always been very interested in some of these some of this information, and now I find a bridge to an actual scientific way to prove and uphold the veracity of the Bible by saying, what if these events actually did take place?
Mm-hmm.
So if the Anunnaki do exist, and they did, you know, have this interaction with us, it's a very long tale that we could have probably one or two shows on.
Right.
But the basic answer is this, is that yes, the Anunnaki probably, you know, are a reality, and they have very specific information they've relayed to the Sumerians about our planet, about our solar system. They accurately depict the distance between the planets on these stone tablets that are 6,000 years old. One of them I have on display on X-Fax, where you can see as a backdrop a complete view of our solar system with the sun in the center and all the planets that we know of. Now, we didn't even know that the sun was in the center. We thought since Galileo and Copernicus that we were basically the center of the solar system, or, you know, And then we found out through telescopes and mathematics that we actually orbit the sun. And here, the Sumerians have laid all this out thousands of years ago, and they very clearly label one of these planets within our own solar system as the home of the Anunnaki.
Mm-hmm.
And we are currently scientifically searching for something called a Planet X, a tenth planet. And that's where the Anunnaki basically have been cited as being from.
I just don't understand the disconnect. We we're running up to our last commercial break here on the Black Vault Radio. It's been a fascinating hour. It's going by way too quick. But I just am fascinated by this disconnect between modern-day science and the wall they put up. And it's like their research will stop at a certain point and not go beyond this, as what you're saying, like this extraterrestrial presence or a confirmation that there is an alien race out there. And I don't see a scientific ramification if that research went beyond that. And number two, I don't see, and maybe I'm wrong, but I wouldn't see a religious ramification if that were to be proven, you know? But I think that society is locked onto the fact that it would be. It would throw all of our beliefs in turmoil. It would throw all of our scientists under the gun that they're cuckoo, and it would be anarchy. And I just don't understand that, because it's a fascinating topic. The evidence is there, not only visually, but scientifically and physically. I mean, you could put this into a court of law and make it stand up.
That's correct.
It's fascinating stuff. Jason Martell, hold on 1 second. Our last commercial break right now.
All
on
right.
The Black Vault Radio. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Black Vault Radio. We've been talking to Jason Martell about potential ancient astronauts, as he called them, visiting Earth, giving us technology that that really we couldn't have come up with on our own. There's kind of this gap in civilization evolution that all of a sudden here this technology comes. Check out xfacts.com. Download this Discovery Channel piece that Jason did. It is really, really, I've used the word fascinating about 1,000 times in this show, but it really is. You got to look at this ancient battery, and Jason himself explains in detail how it's made. It's very simple, and yet he produced 4 volts in a matter of, really, it seems like seconds. Jason, let me ask you before the break.
Yes.
I kind of went on about a little bit about this disconnect, both with the scientific community and the religious community. Why do you think there is this disconnect?
Well, you know, I think the answer, John, from my view, is to say this, is, you know, there's been, you know, a steady interest in this idea of an alternative view to our history of saying, instead of saying religion is right or science is right, a blending of the two, using modern science to prove the ancient knowledge. And when I look at it from this angle, I find evidence that we've never been alone. And the idea that they're visiting us now, beings that aren't human or more advanced than humans that are interacting with our race, has probably been going on for a long time, so it's probably happening today. That then leads to the question, where are they? Why don't we see them? And my answer, just my personal feeling on this, not from a research angle of I can back this up with evidence, my personal feeling on this is Earth is on quarantine. If there's all these other advanced races out there, kind of like a Star Trek conglomerate races of of a society kind of thinking together, I'm sure that they would look at Earth and see us blowing the planet up and warring with each other, and are really not too interested in giving us more technology to come out there and be problems for them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very possible that we are being desensitized publicly to the idea that we aren't alone in the universe, and that there are many more advanced life forms. And I say this because in the 10 years that I've been doing this research, I've seen a much more openness on top-level scientific views from the things like the Discovery Channel, the History Channel, or whatever, having more of an interest in looking at these views. And so I think from all the movies that we see to all the things that are happening, there is some type of desensitizing where, let's just say, the powers that be are slowly making it available for the public to start to be aware of this information. So it's not going to be a huge shock that one day, I don't know when, within our future, there is a crossover point where it's no longer, you know, it's out of the box, and we just kind of get over that hurdle.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be a day where everyone would be like, oh, wow, it's amazing. But just like when we landed on the moon, or when they announced that there was a microbe found in a Mars rock, great, cool, life will go on.
Right. And let me just add one point to that. Being a television producer as myself, as you know, we interviewed
yes.
you for a History Channel show. I've written and produced for History Channel and Discovery Channel. I can tell you from the production angle that people are watching. They love this stuff. And,
right.
you know, regardless of that possible wall coming down from the corporate angle of them doing these shows, what's interesting to me as the producer of these things is that people are tuning in and they get excellent ratings. And I think that is hands down proof beyond any shadow of a doubt society wants this information. You know, they want it. They want to hear it. They want to see the research. And Jason, your research is phenomenal. You've been in this 10 years. We've been in it just about the same time. It's great to have you as a friend. Great to have you as a guest here on the Black Vault Radio.
Same here. Thanks a lot, John.
Absolutely. Out of five, I've got about 23 hours of programming online, and this is by far one of the most fascinating. So thank
Great.
You so much for coming on and sharing your research.
Anytime.
Thank you, Jason, and
Take
thank
care.
You all for tuning in right here on theblackvault.com to BVRN, the Black Vault Radio. You have a wonderful week. We'll see you on Thursday.